For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
So, I'm going to rely on pure effort, I guess, this morning. I'm not exactly sure. I'm going to open my mouth and words will come out. I'll hope that they make sense. I'm not really sure exactly where this is going to go, but when in doubt, bring quotes. So I have a pile of quotes here that I can rely on. So as Tygon mentioned, we've been engaged in this practice period, and most people here are either involved in it or familiar with it. But what we're focusing on are the 10 bodhisattva paramitas, or perfections, these practices that we can sort of use as lenses through which to, I think, to view our practice and focus it. The 10 are, I wrote them down so I wouldn't forget any. I always feel like I forget one or two. But generosity, or the Sanskrit, I'll give the Sanskrit too. It's nice to hear the Sanskrit words, which has some bearing on what we're going to be looking at today. But generosity, or dana, ethical conduct, or shila, patience, kshanti, effort, virya, that's what I'm going to be talking about, meditation, or jhana, wisdom, prajna, skillful means, upaya, vow, pranidhana, powers, bala, and knowledge, jnana. So the lens through which I'm going to focus our attention today is the practice of virya, or effort, often translated as effort. As is often the case in these talks, we explore the, as we start looking at a term or a word or a phrase, if we were looking at something in Japanese or Chinese, we might look at the characters to see what the etymology of it, the origin and the ramifications and the echoes of this term. So the Sanskrit here is virya, which is the same root as virile in English. I think it's very interesting for virility. I think it's a real indication. We get a real feeling or flavor just from that word. I just had as most of you know, I'm an artist, and I had some paintings in a show in Texas that was reviewed recently, and it was a very favorable review, and the woman who reviewed it described my paintings with a few nice adjectives, but one of them was virile. And I was like, I liked it. I mean, that's cool to have your paintings described that way, especially when you're a dude, I guess. But what was she getting at, you know, was my question to myself. But I understood immediately what she was getting at, because she got something that I think I was after in the paintings, which I wouldn't have used the word virile, but maybe active. Activated. Which is something that I think we can aspire to have our practice be, or should aspire to have our practice have that, this virile quality, this activated quality. So we don't come in here and just sit like lumps, you know. There's an active quality to our life and to our practice. Ideally, there should be, I think. So, definitions that are put forward by different translators for this word virya include enthusiasm, effort, diligence, and Thomas Cleary translates it as indomitability in his translation of the Avanamsaka, or Flower Ornament Sutra, which has been referenced a lot. I'm going to ask Tygon about this. My assumption from what I've read is maybe the Avanamsaka is the earliest expression of these 10 paramitas. Is this true?
I believe so, yeah. That's where, there's a much more prevalent version of the first six that are often taught. But then, as a group of 10, I think they come from this Flower Ornament Sutra.
Cool. It would seem to be the source from everything I understood. But let's see if I've got the translation here. Yeah, I found the passage where the Avanamsaka talks about this, and Cleary translates it as indomitability. So what is great enlightening beings' practice of indomitability? Great enlightening beings being bodhisattvas. What is this practice of indomitability? It's a koan in itself. But the passage goes on to explain it as, here the enlightening beings cultivate various forms of energy. And in the typical style of the sutra, it gives a list. It starts listing things. In another place, maybe these could actually be bodhisattvas themselves. There's often these long lists of bodhisattva names. So we could have virya bodhisattvas, and they might be called by these various forms of energy that he begins to list. Foremost energy, great energy, excellent energy, outstanding energy, supreme energy, sublime energy, exalted energy, unsurpassed energy, unequaled energy, comprehensive energy. So even this is something that takes some adjusting in reading these sutras, to go ahead and not just plow through the language to get to the meaning somewhere else. It's actually to just hear these names or these lists, in this case, read. Something gets transmitted. You get a feeling, a flavor. So he goes on to say, or the Avanamsaka goes on to say, they become naturally free from the three poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion. Naturally free from pride and conceit. Naturally not hypocritical. Naturally not stingy or jealous. Naturally not deceitful. Naturally conscientious. Ultimately, they do not make any effort that would afflict a single living being. They only make efforts to cut off all afflictions, to pull out the roots of all confusion, to get rid of all force of habit, to know all realms of all living beings. And it goes on and on and on, as the text tends to do, setting up a completely unattainable ideal of perfection, paramita, that, you know, personally, I feel no hope of ever attaining in some ideal form. But this is, to invoke kind of one of the other paramitas, this is our vow. This is our direction. This is the direction of our practice. And so, this energy, this virile energy that arises, I think, really, and I'll talk more about this as we go on, but I think it's a very naturally arising energy that comes forth that brought us here today to sit together and to contemplate these practices together. So, something changes from maybe these early Mahayana sutras. The Mahayana being a kind of reform, maybe a reform movement that it could be considered in Buddhist history at a certain point. There was the historical Buddha and a certain kind of practice developed, a certain accepted form of practice, some kind of standards, and then a reform movement happened, and maybe we call it the Mahayana. And then later, other reform movements happened. They're perpetually happening. We have to keep renewing this practice, and we're doing it for ourselves just right now. And at a certain point, it happened in this thing called Zen, Chan in Chinese, coming from, you know, one of our paramitas, jhana, in the Sanskrit, meaning meditation. A school arose that really emphasized meditation, and so they took In Chinese, they took the jhana and they called it chan, and then when it got to Japan, it became Zen. And it was this reform movement. So I've been looking at one of our Zen, founding Zen texts, a very important one, and wondering how I could relate various paramitas, these 10 practices, to kind of the roots of our Zen tradition. So the most famous, perhaps, text in our school from our founder, Dogen, is the Genjo Koan. So I'm sure most of us are pretty familiar with Genjo Koan. The Genjo Koan doesn't speak specifically anywhere about these 10 practices. But as I looked at it, it's kind of can be broken down into these sections. And you could relate any of the 10 practices, I think, to any particular section. But the general direction of the text, and I think our practice, is towards, but it's really made palpable, I think, in Genjo Koan, is this attempt to heal dualism, to heal alienation. That's why we come here, right? We feel some sense of split. So I've been thinking about this word healing, really deeply thinking about trying to experience in my own body mind healing. What is it? Again, etymologically, very interesting. To heal, the word heal, very early Indo-European word that's the same root as whole, right? Wholeness. To heal is to make whole. Also, when you look it up, it puts other words in there. Renew, restore, even remember. To remember, to put back together, to put the members back together, to put the parts, to reconnect them, which of course in Latin is religio, which is the root of religion. And then, of course, we've got yoga, from the same root as yoke, to put together. So it's all about coming together. And so I think the Genjo Koan is this very poetic and linguistic effort, virya, to heal some fundamental kind of splits in the way we perceive ourselves in the world. That, of course, being the fundamental split. We think of having a self, and we think that there's a world separate from ourself. And that, to bring this back around to our virya, this effort, I think that we can think that there's effort that we can somehow exert to heal that wound. Sometimes we are in times in our practice, or moments in our zazen, where we start pressing or pushing or exerting ourselves to try to fix something. And this is very interesting to track this. So Genjo Koan indicates again and again that, well, it says quite explicitly, if we carry ourselves forward, if we sort of assert ourselves egoically, we actually we get further away. We actually widen the divide. We exacerbate it. We make things worse. So what is the quality of effort? How can this be a perfection if through the self we're exerting ourselves, or we're exerting this effort? It's possible for us to be simply reinforcing the very qualities that are causing this feeling, this sensation of alienation. And I don't think our practice should be doing that. But when it does, it's a really wonderful opportunity to just see the mechanisms of how this happens. What are the mechanisms that cause us to turn this practice, which we come to for healing, and yet we just turn it into another mechanism of dis-ease? And that seems very unfortunate, but also very instructive and helpful. So we don't just come... I was giving Zazen instruction this morning, and I guess most of the time when I do that, I notice to myself and to the other people that we don't come in, and while we want relaxation and wholeness and settling, we don't come in and just flop out on the floor or lean against the wall or, you know, kind of slump over and hang out. You know, there's time for this too, you know, but we come in and we sit in this upright way, and we have all these rules and regulations. And so from the outside, it could appear that all of this would indicate this kind of military regimentation that would further indicate a kind of military effort or attitude or posture. And you see people practice that way, and I think we all find moments when we practice like that. And that's not necessarily so bad either. Sometimes maybe we need that, or that's called for. But I think generally the more I practice, the more I realize that I want to have enthusiasm for our practice and for this activity that I'm so engaged with. So, you know, that word too, I love these words, they have connotations. So we think about enthusiasm and maybe a generally American attitude or posture towards enthusiasm is this kind of big plastic grin, right? And, you know, happy, happy, joy, joy. Ren and Stimpy, you know that cartoon? A happy, happy, joy, joy kind of thing. But that's not our Zen way. Our enthusiasm is different than that. So what's it like? You know, what's our enthusiasm like in the Zen way? And some of these other words, diligence. What's our diligence like? What's our indomitability, if we're going to translate it that way? So again, it's not this kind of hard... Indomitability sounds really kind of tough. Like you think of square-jawed, flat-top, marine-type guys. That's what I think of when I think of indomitability. And I don't feel like that. And the more I practice, maybe the less I feel indomitable, or even diligent. I think in this practice period, Aishin, Nancy and I were talking about this. We had lunch the other day, and we were talking about, you know, here we are wearing these robes and the bald heads, and we're the authorities, right? We're talking about how when we come to the practice discussion like we're going to have this afternoon, and we hear about other people's practice, we're like, wow, they're practicing so hard. We're just slackers. We're Zen slackers. You can have that feeling. That can be part of the feeling that comes up. And maybe you've felt that way at some point. But some, when you have a practice period like this, and especially we're not living in a monastery, so you're kind of left to your own devices a lot of the time. And so you have to find this quality of effort on your own terms. And, I remembered a wonderful quote just in this Zazen period, kicking around in my brain was the thought I was going to have to give this talk. And this, I remembered this great quote from this, a talk by this poet, David White, British poet. And he talked about effort and how each day, he's talking about the creative process, and I'm certainly familiar with this as an artist. You go in the studio and you're like, what kind of effort do I have to bring today? And it's like that when we come to the Zendo. This is our studio. This is our creative studio, our creative Zazen studio. And so what kind of effort do we have today? It's not the same every day. So there's not one kind of, there's not this perfection. We use these words, but then we look at them carefully and we realize how they don't mean what we think that they mean. It's not this fixed, rigid format. It's this posture of inquiry. That's our Zazen way, our Zen way. It's a posture of inquiry and curiosity. And so that's the kind of enthusiasm that we have. It's more like a raised eyebrow, not a big plastic grin. And made me just think of that picture of Suzuki Roshi, the very famous one. Maybe many of you have Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and there's that very famous picture. And you know how Suzuki Roshi's face is kind of crooked? He's got two faces, and one side, he's got this raised eyebrow. It's just gazing at you with this kind of enthusiastic curiosity, I think. And then the other side looks kind of like samurai warrior. So maybe that photograph tells us a lot about our practice too. You know, we have both of those sides of it. There is this indomitable samurai warrior that can arise in circumstances that call for that. But there's also this kind of childlike, enthusiastic curiosity that is the other side of our practice. And just like Genjo Koan says, maybe when one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. We can only know one side, maybe, at a time. But we realize through practice that there's a lot of space for all of these things, all of these selves, to arise and develop and grow together. This is also Genjo Koan, that all of these myriad phenomena can coexist together. This is Avaramsaka too. Everything comes up together. It arises together. All of these selves that we are arise together. So this is the funny thing. The Genjo Koan doesn't give us a bunch of New Age platitudes. Everything is one, dude. That's not what it says. It's everything's one and everything's many at the same time. This is our Buddhist teaching. So this, you know, when the truth at the heart of everything, there's a paradox. And so the paradox of, and Zen gets very intimate with the paradoxical nature of our life. It gives us a place to just come and shut up and be intimate with this paradox that we are not separate, and yet we're completely separate and integral at the same time. So our effort has this paradoxical quality too, and that's really, it's perfectly embodied in our Zazen posture. We're both completely upright and alert and engaged, and at the same time we're completely settling and relaxed and detached. How those things both happen at the same time can only be experienced. But even as I say that, I'm not sure we can't know it in our brain. Like, our hungry brain wants to know it. And so I guess the purpose of these talks that we give is to kind of feed the hungry brain and engage it and get it kind of going in the right courses. But the hungry brain can't actually grok fully the mystery. That's why, again, our tradition is practice itself is enlightenment. And when you, from Genja Koan, when you think you're enlightened, maybe we could say, to kind of paraphrase it, when you think you're close to enlightenment, you're actually very far away. And when you think you're very far away, maybe you're very intimate with it. You're very close. So to bring it back around to this issue of our effort, for me, well, there's one of the aspects that comes up is just showing up. So you guys all just showed up today. It seems like maybe that's enough. That's enough. You don't need extra. So Zen is all about cutting out the extra. So again, I think in our positivist society, this idea of effort is often about it's about something extra. And we want to find that pocket. We're continually seeking, inquiring into where the pocket is in our life, moment to moment. And in that pocket, I think there's a natural wellspring of enthusiasm and virility and liveliness that is accessible to us. And our Zen tradition provides these tools, and both physical tools and psychological tools and spiritual tools, technologies, we might say, spiritual technologies, to help us in our journey, in our very individual and personal journey, to find that pocket and keep finding it and keep returning to it. That pocket being this kind of wholeness that we seek, this healing. That's what we come here wanting to know and to be intimate with. At least that's what I come here wanting to know and be intimate with. So what does it look like? There's a quote. I'm quoting our teacher Taigen quoting Dogen. I have a feeling this is probably a favorite quote, passage of Dogen for Taigen, I'm guessing. But he led off a wonderful essay in a new book about Dogen. It's a book of essays by various scholars, and including Taigen, our teacher. And he starts off his essay with this quote. So we look to these texts and we get all kinds of kind of modeling behavior for what does it look like? What does an enlightened life look like? Or what does our practice look like? And we get these ideas and we know that they're off at some level. Some gears are creaking. And so we maybe pick up a Zen book to try and get some indication of where we're missing. What's not catching? Where do we need some grease on those wheels? And I think there's some good, very good instruction here. I think maybe this is the whole kit and caboodle in this quote. But entering the water without avoiding deep dragons is the courage of a fisherman. This is Dogen speaking. So entering the water without avoiding deep sea dragons is the courage of a fisherman. Traveling the earth without avoiding tigers is the courage of a hunter. Facing the drawn sword before you and seeing death as just like life is the courage of a general. What is the courage of patch-robed monks? That's us. What is our courage coming and sitting here today? There's a pause. And Dogen goes on to say, spread out your bedding and sleep. Set out your bowls and eat rice. Exhale through your nostrils. Radiate light from your eyes. Do you know there is something that goes beyond? With vitality, eat lots of rice and then use the toilet. Transcend your personal prediction of future Buddhahood from Gautama. That's the end. So, clearly these ideals are set up. Ideals for other beings, fishermen, hunters, generals. This word courage, I think we could translate it into various other of the paramitas. It could be the generosity of a general is that way, or the generosity of the hunter. It could be the power of the hunter or the general. But it could also be the effort, the virya. What is the quality of the effort of a general or the quality of the effort of a hunter? And he gives some indications, but then what's the quality of the effort of a Zen practitioner, of a Zen person? And it's just to, with virility, to go about your business without anything extra. And this is a practice. We have to practice it. We don't have a big awakening experience and then everything's gravy. You have to, because one awakening experience is only in that moment. In the next moment, you've got another set of conditions. So in the midst of that, we find this balance through our practice, a centeredness, a wholeness that allows us to have a response ability to respond to conditions. I like, and I know Teigen likes this line too, radiate light from your eyes. Radiate light from your eyes, he tells us, right? Explicitly, radiate light from your eyes, which is again one of these things he does. We think of light coming into our eyes, but we know that light shines out of our eyes. We know that. We see it in others. We know days when the light's shining out of our eyes, and we know the days when it's, when they're just black holes of exhaustion and we need a vacation. I'm enjoying a week off from having had a very taxing academic year teaching. I had way too many classes and I just was run a bit ragged. And this last week, I just really felt it. Like how thin I had been stretched. At the time, I had the energy and I felt enthusiastic. But by the end, that enthusiasm had waned. So I'm enthusiastically this week with a great deal of energy sitting on the couch quite a bit, watching Battlestar Galactica on Netflix. So I've been doing that with a great deal of diligence and energy. So that's been very good for me. So I think that's pretty good. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Keizan. Does anyone have comments or questions or responses about this practice of effort? Please feel free. Douglas.
Maybe it's always been sort of a challenge to me on the part of this, to be trying to figure out what it was talking about, and the fact that there's so many translations. It's also part of the problem, I think. And I like your talking about energy and enthusiasm. I like those terms better than effort. Effort does, you know, make it sound like, okay, you're trying to lift some heavy weight or run out of race and you're going to collapse. And I think that Virya is really trying to say you can't coast or be passive in your practice for your life, that you have to bring some vitality to it and be engaged. It's wholeheartedness. And that that's both for specific practices we do, like zazen, and for life generally, moment to moment. We have to keep bringing the vitality and the engagement to each moment. I think that's kind of a corrective for me, because I either, you know, I tend to bounce back and forth between sort of a passivity and coasting, or trying really, really hard, and that's not it. It's really being alive and committed to what's going on.
Yeah. Well, it makes me think of another, you know, the other quote that I brought that I didn't read. Maybe I'll just read it now real quick. There's this guy, Nisargadatta Maharaj. Has anybody heard of him? He's an Indian Vedantic teacher, lived in the last century, lived to be quite old. And he was a shopkeeper. And he was an ordained kind of empowered representative of a certain Vedantic tradition. But just kind of like we feel, I think, about Zen, it's like there's Zen goes beyond Zen. Awakening goes beyond Zen. It's not Zen dependent. So it's not dependent on our practice. And so what is it dependent on? And he speaks very explicitly about, he says, I highlighted here, your very nature has the infinite capacity to enjoy. It is full of zest and affection. It sheds its radiance on all that comes within its focus of awareness, and nothing is excluded. This, you know, he speaks at length about, this is our natural state. Our natural state of being, our true being, our true self, is naturally enthusiastic. It's naturally affectionate. It's naturally loving. It's naturally energetic. It's natural. So we just have to be natural. So it's not about adding this extra stuff, just like you said, or pulling back away. But we are these partial beings with karma. And so at times we pull away, attraction and repulsion, you know. This is Genjo Kōan. He speaks very explicitly about it. Aversion and desire. And we see that, and we find it in our posture. You know, you can just watch people walking down the street. Some people are, I've heard, you know, kinesiologists talk about this. Some people press the pelvis forward and the upper body goes backwards. It's kind of a passive-aggressive relationship to reality. And this is how they describe it. And this is the psychology of the body. And then you have that military stance, or it's described as the busybody kind of stance, where the pelvis is thrust back and the chest is thrust forward. You know, that's how soldiers stand. That's kind of another posture. But our posture is different. It's about centering and finding this balance. And we can see it in ourselves when we're leaning one way or the other, or forward or backward. Maybe that, I don't know. I mean, I don't experience it this way necessarily, but maybe it indicates an unbalanced relationship with something in our body-mind. Or maybe we can just find a much bigger sense of balance where it's beyond what our body's doing or not doing. I don't know. But just this sense of natural functioning, of our natural enthusiasm. That's what made me think of Douglas. So thank you. Yeah, Ishan.
So, thank you for a really good talk. I guess I'm not exercise my vocal cords today.
I'll drink for both of us.
Thank you. I liked how you were talking about energy and effort and finding a balance with that, and it also was making me think about another quote from Dogen in Instructions to the Tenzo, where he talks about put things that belong in a high place in a high place, and things that belong in a low place in a low place, and you wouldn't handle a sharp knife the same way that you would handle a wooden spoon. And I was thinking about how we can also bring different aspects of energy differentially to the different things. But yes, you know, he actually, in the translations that I've seen, he says, treat each thing the same, or something along those lines. But I don't think he means treat a sharp knife like a wooden spoon. What I think he's meaning is bring that the same proper quality of energy to each different thing. And I was thinking about how that relates to kind of what you're talking about meeting each circumstance with the proper amount of energy for that circumstance. I went on a very long bike ride yesterday, longer than I ever thought I could ride. Not because I was trying, it just, we had a map and we followed the map, but I found that, you know, when you're going uphill, you just go up the hill, you know, and then don't keep, you know, spinning your wheels while you're going downhill or along the flats. It's just, you know, when you're going up a hill, that's what you do, and when you go down the hill, you know, you can relax a little bit. And so, you know, without having that goal in mind of bringing yourself forward, you can just enjoy the trip.
Mm. Yeah.
So, and I was just sort of reflecting on that as you were talking about different ways of being energetic in the world and meeting each thing as it is.
Well, I was thinking that with, you know, your practice as a psychologist, one of our many psychology professionals. And I was, just as you were speaking, I was like, yeah, I mean, of course you need to treat all of your patients with the same kind of attitude of compassion and engagement and attention, but of course you can't treat them all the same. That would be disastrous. So, and then, but how can you, you can't figure out a program to deal with all these different people. You just can't. It's art. Just like our practice is this art of practice. You have to, it has to come from somewhere else, from this, like I said, wellspring maybe. And how do you tap into that wellspring? This is our koan, you know. And getting back to Douglas's point, and kind of like I was saying earlier, if you can just make things worse if you try too hard or not hard enough. You have to find this right place. And rationally, it's just completely overwhelming, just even as I think about it right now, to think about some program to do that. Luckily, and it can be very overwhelming just walking in here, right, you guys? I mean, you just walk in here. Some days it feels very overwhelming. And you have new people. It's got to be, you know, thank you very much for the courage to come. This is the courage of pastor of monks. You share the courage of Zen practitioners. We all, some days, it feels like a courageous act to just show up. And that's enough, maybe. Yeah, thanks, Aisha.
Right. I liked your idea of describing this as sort of our studio. And when you talk about virility, I think of also, you know, fecundity, the ability to grow something. And I think that with the energy of that, we can bring a lot of creativity, we can bring a lot of fresh mind to it. And so it seems like a lot of our practice, a lot of our courage is coming in after, you know, 10 years, 20 years and saying, oh, we're going to meditate today. I wonder what that's like. You know, of keeping it fresh and new, which takes that effort, but it also brings us back to an openness about, you know, yes, it's this and it's that. It's both. It's, you know, effort but not effort. It's, you know, those tensions that we have, those dichotomies. When we get to a place where they're both together, then that energy is there, that creativity is there, that fecundity is there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Aisha and I were talking about how when we give these talks, it's so nice to have the question and answer section because it touches on points, you know, you thought of as you were musing for the weeks before your talk or whatever, and you forget to mention it. So that this idea of fecundity and also sustainability, it's like sustainable agriculture. I think we really have to have a sustainable practice. So this quality of enthusiasm, we don't want to just have, so at the beginning, maybe we have this kind of enthusiasm and you see it and it's veteran practitioners, you watch people come and they're very excited at the beginning. And you remember that enthusiasm too. But there's also a sense of, well, maybe chill out a little bit because it's a long road, you know, and you got to find a sense of balance about your practice so that it's sustainable and you don't burn yourself out. You have a bunch of energy, you throw a bunch of effort at it, and that burns itself out, and then what have you got? You know, do you just hate Zen because you burned yourself out, and then Zen is just a mistress that didn't fulfill all of your expectations or something? You know, we've got to have a sustainable, loving marriage with our practice, I think. And that's a different kind of enthusiasm. It's a different kind of diligence. It's a different kind of effort.